let's find out a bit more about Magna Carta, how important it really is and what it really actually says. Malcolm Stewart is Vice President of the Rule of Law Institute of Australia and a member of the Magna Carta Australia Committee. Malcolm, good morning.
Good morning, Linda. How are you?
Well, thank you. And I guess we should all say happy birthday to each other or something, shouldn't we?
Thank you. I should add to your introduction that no monarch in England has been called John since King John of 1215.
Well, you wouldn't want to be with that reputation, no, would you? So he really pulled beards, is that true?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure. I don't know, but he was certainly regarded as a tyrant.
Yes, indeed, indeed. So Magna Carta, what is it exactly?
Magna Carta is... its translation is the Great Charter. It is considered now, I think, by many to be sort of the foundation document for legal systems around the world, including Australia and those that derive their laws from England. But at the time, it was nothing more than a peace treaty between the barons of England and King John. What had happened in the previous few years that John had waged a number of wars overseas, in particular in France. He had lost two very important wars, one in Normandy and one at Bovines, and decisively lost them. In order to run those campaigns, he had inflicted very punitive taxes. He'd confiscated property of barons, but very significant castles and lands. And what was happening is that the barons who were able to control parts of England started to rebel against King John, and he lost significant parts of England in those rebellions, including London and other parts in northern England. And so what happened, in essence, was the barons and King John got together, as you say, at Runnymede. There were negotiations which were conducted, and the church looms large, I have to say, in the Magna Carta story. Stephen Langton, the then Archbishop of Canterbury, which, of course, England was Catholic at the time, he became a negotiator between the barons and King John, and eventually they were able to agree on this peace treaty to end the civil war in England, which was the Magna Carta.
Mm. Now, it didn't necessarily work terribly well, though, did it, at the start?
No, King John really did not want to sign it. He was, or I should say put his seal on it, he never actually signed it, but he did not want to do that. It only lasted several months. In fact, about 10 weeks is all it lasted, and this is where the church looms large again in this. He went off to see Pope Innocent III in the Vatican, and he made a declaration, which is also available in the British Museum. You can see the original of that, annulling the Magna Carta of 1215.
Okay, so how do we get to still celebrate it now?
What happened was John died soon after that. His son, one of his sons, Henry, a couple of years later reinstated the Magna Carta. It then, over the next years up till 1297, was reissued and amended on several occasions. The most important of those documents is 1297, but we look at the 1215 one as being the beginning of that process. The 1297 one, I think there are no more than a handful of originals, of which one of those originals is in Parliament House in Canberra, contained in argon gas, but you can actually see the original 1297 Magna Carta there. It's not going to be very interesting to read in the sense that it's written in medieval Latin, which only vaguely looks like English.
I don't think they had full stops and gaps in their words days.
And they tend to... that's worth now tens and tens of millions of dollars. Mm. So it was a very good purchase. It was only purchased for several tens of thousands of dollars, I think the 60s or the 70s.
Well, there you go. Well, I learned yesterday that the State Library here in New South Wales has a 1330 edition as well, which is on display at the moment at their Amaze exhibition. So
right. There
you go.
Yeah.
So Malcolm Stewart is with us, Vice President of the Rule of Law Institute of Australia, and there's a hint in there, and a member of the Magna Carta Australia Committee. The rule of law is really the key here, isn't it, in terms of our memory of what, or our celebration of the Magna Carta?
It is. The Magna Carta was really the first document we associate with the rule of law, where in fact you have a monarch in England giving up some of their powers and is putting forward a document which he then seals and agrees to be bound by what that document says. That's the first time that occurs. Prior to that, we're talking about a king who believed he had divine right. If he woke up in the morning and said he was going to confiscate your property was confiscated. Or if he said he was going to impose punitive taxes, then that's what occurred. So it was a move from this absolute rule by a dictator to a set document where his powers are now prescribed in particular ways.
And so, so many hundreds of years on, that really is echoed in our system,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you can go through all the history from 1215, if you want, through to the Bill of Rights, which is really the end of this critical period in England, which is 1689. But today, I think what most people are interested in, well, what on earth has that got to do with today? Well, it's actually got a lot to do with today. And if I could just mention to you a few critical things. One is that I and other members of the Rule of Law Institute have written about publicly, and that is ICAC and its excess of powers, and in particular its treatment of Margaret Keneen, the senior Crown Prosecutor of New South Wales. That's one area where the rule of law looms large, and you have a regulator far and away exceeding the powers that it should be exercising. So that's just one example of that. The next one that is mentioned, particularly in the last few days, is this question of citizenship and terrorism and whether terrorists should have their citizenship cancelled, and in particular how that should be done. Should that be done by a minister making a decision with some wide powers of discretion, arbitrary power almost, or should that go to an independent judiciary that's not going to be infected by all that political influence that you would expect a minister to have? Mm. So that's a critical debate there. And obviously the rule of law, principled rule of law, would point to saying no, have the decision made by an independent judiciary, have a full hearing on it, not simply a review of the minister's decision, allow a full independent judiciary to determine that, because that will give confidence in the decision as opposed to the minister making a decision which is may simply be reviewed by a judge. And there are many other examples too, I should add.
Yes, I'm sure there are. I just want to read out actually the phrases that get us to that stage of having all of this enshrined, and I guess we also see it in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the US Constitution, but the original words that were basically, no free man shall be seized or imprisoned or stripped of his rights or possessions or outlawed or exiled or deprived of his standing in any other way, nor will we proceed with force against him or send others to do so, except by the lawful judgment of his equals or by the law of the land. To no one will we sell, to no one deny or delay right or justice.
Absolutely.
Critical words.
It is, and that talks about a slightly different principle too, which is the absolute supremacy of the law, that everybody is bound by the law, and that is key here. Mm. So whether it be a government or a monarch, you are just as much subject to the law as you or I or anyone else is. So you have this equality within the law, which is the thing that tries to get away from these wide discretions and talks about certainty of the law. You've got to understand what it is. It's got to be easily accessible. Yep. Those type of things are part of that principle. The second one you talked about, equality before the law, well, that's reasonably obvious. You don't have officials who don't have to comply with the law. Independent judiciary, I regard the independent judiciary as the most important of these principles, where you have someone who's not infected with or not influenced by political considerations in making a completely independent decision. And what goes along with that is access to courts in terms of legal aid. You need, indeed, in New South Wales and the Commonwealth, we have independent prosecutors. There's not a politician making a decision on, or a minister making a decision on, who we should prosecute. And we have open and fair trials. And that is, I think, the most important, because I think part of the Rule of Law Institute, when we started off as an organisation that tried to influence laws through Parliament, it just became too hard because we got nowhere. You could go to standing committees and give evidence to them and talk to politicians. They weren't that interested in sort of that sort of principled approach. But what we've now turned our attention to is education. So we, in fact, engage a number of teachers that go to schools throughout Australia and speak to legal studies students in year 11 and year 12 and explain the rule of law to them. And we've got quite a good uptake on that now. That's one of the things we now do.
Maybe you could go to the Parliament as well and pass on that knowledge there.
Oh, we have.
Malcolm Stewart is with me from the Rule of Law Institute of Australia, and he's a member of the Magna Carta Australia Committee. As the world remembers the Magna Carta, thinks about the Magna Carta, 800 years since it was first written, there are a few other bits and pieces in there that were less, shall we say, salubrious.
Yes.
Demanding the removal of fish weirs from the Thames.
Yes. Yes. Those clauses have to be seen at the times. I mean, there are parts of the Magna Carta that you wouldn't like, for example, One of the clauses goes something like the effect that a woman cannot give evidence against a man for murder unless the, you know, the victim is her husband. And so there are ones like that. And there are other worse ones than that that I needn't get into as well. There are many parts of that document that are a sign of the times. So the clauses you've referred to really make that document foundational, because they were the ones that kept going through time, and whereas the others have all fallen away, fortunately. But those ones have kept going. And as you said, we now find in US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and many countries that adopted the common law process. And indeed, other countries, for example, like China, talk about the rule of law and how important that is to them. And other countries are sort of, I think, at least adopting the wording that they want to be rule of law countries. Many other countries are like that. They don't have the historical background to it like Australia does, because we inherited our laws from England.
Yeah.
And indeed, it has been held by the High Court that our constitution is a presumption under our constitution of the rule of law. So yeah. It's very important to us.
Well, Malcolm, enjoy the celebrations. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Happy to talk.